Don't be shy. Step a little closer. I've been waiting to welcome you to Fright Radio. The name is Reaper. Radio Reaper. I have much to tell. It's enough to make someone scream. What a coincidence. Let's step inside, shall we? Welcome to Fright Radio, the radio show for Halloween enthusiasts, home and professional haunters alike. I am your Radio Reaper, and we have a great show lined up for you. Our policeman from the RIPD, Ghoulish Cop, talks about the use of color in our haunts in his segment, Fade to Black. The Toy Haunter stops by with his review of the new Walking Dead action figure line. Miss Mischief will dig up the latest in convention news. Chris and Jeff Davis give us a how-to for building your very own creepy facade. Mr. Chicken will scare up the spooks in his Hall of Illusions. Dr. Midstonian brings a new creation to life in the Mad Lab. And I, your Radio Reaper, we'll interview Rob Cometti of Mucklebones, LLC. Now let's get the show started with our musical guests, the Messerchoops, while they do the Chupacabra Twist. Chupacabra Twist.
This is Rich, better known as Ghoulish Cop, on the forums, chats, and video channels. And while my previous career may have been identified with the color blue, as a haunter, more often than not, I've become acquainted with the color black. And in looking at many other haunts around the country, it seems I'm not alone. Whether it's a tombstone or column, a facade or a skeleton, haunters seem to have collectively raided the oops paint section of Home Depot and Lowe's and bought up all the black paint. And by black, I mean it's all of its varying shades, from deeper slates to lighter grays. It's as if all the goth kids at the midnight showing of Rocky Horror Picture Show got together and decided to make a haunted house. Now, I'm as guilty as the next haunter of overdoing the doom and gloom look of my yard display, and there is something to be said for the dreary look. It creates a mood and heightens the sense of dread that we're trying to instill in the people who visit our yards and haunted houses. But I'm coming around to the idea that we're working at cross purposes to what we really want to achieve. I was recently looking at a set of pictures online of an abandoned amusement park. It was destroyed by a storm and never rebuilt, and was left to rust and rot. Its desolate condition, the imposing structures, the rust and ruin all served to create a creeping feeling of horror. And what struck me about the scenes, and what convinced me the real catalyst for this sense of foreboding, was the presence of color. And not muted color, but bright, vibrant reds and yellows, blues and greens. Sure, they had been covered over with the muck of time and neglect, but it was still apparent the boldness of the color was what was driving the scene. Which got me to thinking, even though Hollywood likes to present a dim, apocalyptic view of the future, filled with grays, blues, and blacks, any desolation we see in reality is just a diminished view of what's all around us today, and that's color. When there's an abandoned old house, it's not usually black or gray, but rather it's yellow or pink or blue and pretty run down. When there's an abandoned barn, it's not black or gray, but red. An industrial scene might bring to mind grays, but that's only because of what we see on TV or at the movies. In reality, walls are painted yellows, creams, greens, and blues again. So what we haunters need to do is employ that in our own haunts. Circus or carnival haunts tend to do this more than other haunt styles, but it's something each of us can do in our own haunts regardless of the theme. My own haunt theme is one of a rundown monastery. And while that might cause one to think it'll be a gray edifice, when you look at the historical pictures of these places, you see, too, that they were built with color. So perhaps they have faded with age and time and neglect, but we should be able to see the color that was there, and it's what I plan on to incorporate as I build it up over the next few seasons. So let's make a pact together to eschew the monochromatic style and add some splashes of color, because we all don't have to buy into Henry Ford's old saying about his Model T. You can have it in any color you want, so long as it's black.
You've got the Toy Haunter here. Most of you will know me from my YouTube channel, Columbia Manor Haunted House. For those of you who don't know me, I am a year-round haunter, vlogger, Halloween enthusiast, and collector of rare and hard-to-find toys from TV, movies, and anything horror and haunt-related. I also run a series on my YouTube channel called The Toy Haunter, where I talk about new, vintage, popular, and hard-to-find toys. I also show garage sale, thrift store, and flea market finds as well. Now, I'm excited to be bringing the Toy Haunter series here to Fright Radio, and I'll be reviewing new lines coming out, as well as old favorites. This should be a lot of fun, and I'm extremely excited to be able to use this platform to talk about one of my passions. So with that, let's jump right into the first series I want to review, and that is a new series being released by McFarlane Toys, The Walking Dead Comic Series 2. As you know, the comic book series characters look a lot different than the TV characters. Now, the release date is set for August, so they really can hit the stores any time now. So let me go ahead and talk about the four characters they're releasing. Now, they're releasing Glenn, they're releasing the Governor, and they're releasing Michonne's pet zombie Mike, as well as Penny, the Governor's zombie daughter. Penny is by far my favorite in this line, I'll talk about her last because she's just amazing. So Glenn is a lot different than the TV series Glenn we know. In the comic book series, he's a lot more badass. He's in this character, he's full-on in SWAT gear from head to toe. He's got a baton in hand. He's got two guns on his hips. He's got blood spatter all over him. He's going to have a SWAT mask. He'll have a SWAT shield with blood spatter all over it. He's just a lot different than the softer Glenn that we know from the TV series. So a lot of people were wondering why they didn't have a big, tough, rugged Glenn on the TV show. And that's because, you know, they needed Rick to be the big, tough, you know, guy like that. So they made him a lot softer and just for probably a change of pace of character with the Glenn on the TV show. So now the Governor is a lot different. This Governor is nothing like what we see in the TV series, and if you didn't know the TV series and you saw this Governor in stores, you would think that he's just a bad guy and not like a leader of any kind of anything. So the Governor here has got like a Fu Manchu mustache. He's got like a 5 o'clock shadow that's very dark and scruffy. He just overall looks scruffy. He's got some torn cargo pants on in his knees. He's very dirty. He's got high combat boots on with dirt all over the bottom of the shoes. He'll be carrying a knife in hand. He'll have a gun at his hip. He'll be wearing a vest, long hair kind of slicked back, and he just looks nothing like the Governor that we know from the TV show at all. Now, Michonne's pet zombie, this is a pretty cool figure. They've released some zombies in the previous TV show lines, and this one is by far my favorite zombie they've released yet. So it just looks a lot different. He's very realistic. He's got some dirty jeans on, torn at the knees, blood everywhere, no shoes. He has his collar on with the chain going down to the floor. Two arms, only one hand, blood all over the place on him. His torso is ripped apart. He's got guts flying out of him, basically. His skin is decaying. His face is kind of looking up, kind of in a Bernie Lean kind of stance. Eyes are white with like a blue center, just looking creepy as hell. Mouth wide open, blood everywhere. And this Mike character looks really, really good. And I'm really impressed with the detail on that character. And he is probably my favorite zombie to be released yet. And I'm sure I'm going to want to buy, you know, him, probably multiples of him. So now Penny is by far the best character that I think McFarlane's put out for this Walking Dead line, whether it be comic book series or the TV line. She just looks really cool. She looks a lot like the Spirit Halloween walking doll that was kind of released during last year's Halloween. And she just looks amazing. She's got her pink dress on with white ruffles around the waist, blood everywhere. There's a couple holes. It's shredded at the bottom. She's kind of standing in an attack stance with her arms a little bit off her hips. Her hands are out kind of like claws, blood on fingertips kind of dripping off. Her legs and arms are decaying in the skin, blood just dripping down her everywhere. Her face is amazing. She has blood on her face, kind of an open mouth kind of look with blood around it like she just eaten somebody. Her eyes are blue with a dark center, which look really cool, and it gives it a great zombie slash vampire scare look. Her hair's up in pigtails with bows on the ends, blood on the bows, and she just looks like a phenomenal character. As soon as I find her, I'm going to buy her every time I see her, just because, you know, the girl toys in any toy line, whether it's a movie like G.I. Joe or whether it's a horror thing like, you know, The Walking Dead, the girl toys are very rare, they're very hard to come across, and they're usually short packaged in the cases that are sent out to stores. So just to talk about the build a little bit of the figures, their original paint They're going to be 4 to 4.5 inches. They are an action figure is their category. They're also going to be on the blister card, so it'll be nice and firm and very nice packaging as well. Now, if you're looking to buy these, you could probably find them on Amazon.com. You'll be able to find it at Toys R Us for sure. They'll be at GameStop. They'll be at any specialty hobby or comic book store as well. I think also Clark Toys may have them, as well as there's a website called Big Bad Toy Store, which is pretty cool. They'll most likely have them there as well. Overall, this is a pretty cool line with the four characters being released. They all look really good. I just really prefer the TV show over the comic book series. And the variances between the two Glens and the two Governors kind of throws me off. And it's going to throw off some fans who haven't seen the comic book series. You know, the comic book series was released first, and then AMC turned that into the hit TV show we know right now. So it is a very cool line. Penny is by far my favorite, like I talked about, but it's a cool line. So if anybody's interested, I talked about the stores you can find them at. Go out and grab them. Put them to your collection if you're an avid collector. If you're a new collector, this might be something fun to get you started with. They do look really cool, and they're going to be fun to have around the house, whether you want to open them and pose them, or if you want to just keep them in the packaging and display them that way. Either way, it's totally cool. So if we're going to talk about ratings, I'm thinking something fun to do would maybe give it, you know, instead of giving it 5 stars, I'm thinking we should go, because this is a haunt show and a horror show, let's go with skulls. So on a rating of 1 to 5, I'd probably give it 4 skulls, just because the detail McFarlane does is extremely nice and very accurate, and they're just really, really cool figures to have around. So I'll give it 4 skulls, with Penny being my favorite character in the line by far. So I think that's it for now, guys. So I just want to say thanks for listening. And if anyone has a toy line or any specific request on toys you want me to review, feel free to email me. My email is columbiamanor@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to me on YouTube as well. I've got upcoming Halloween build videos coming up for the 2013 haunt. I'm doing a haunt I'm calling the Devil's Carnival. So there will be haunt build videos, as well as more Toy Haunter episodes coming up as well. Thanks again for listening, and I will scare you later.
Convention news.
Hi, this is Miss Mischief with your convention news for the month of September. Scarecon, horror and sci-fi fan convention, September 12th through the 15th, in Verona, New York, Turning Stone Resort and Casino. Horror, sci-fi convention and film festival featuring vendors, parties, and celebrities including Ernie Hudson, Margaret Kidder, Melissa Rose, Linnea Quigley, Butch Patrick, and more. Hotel, 500 Canal Street. The Mad Monster magazine takes their party to a second city for 2013. Many special events and guests including Gunnar Hansen, Heather Ligenkamp, Peter Chris, Cynthia Morial, The Beyond, Ogre, PJ Souls, and Derek Mears. Scarefest Horror and Paranormal Convention, September 13th to the 15th in Lexington, Kentucky, Lexington Convention Center. This 6th annual massive convention is a combo of horror and paranormal guests and events. Guests this year will include Sean Cunningham, Jeffrey Combs, Amy Steele, and more. Everybody Dies Horror Film Festival, September 13th to the 15th, Brea, California. The Everybody Dies Horror Film Festival will be back for year 3, delivering the best in indie horror flicks. Fanzacon, September 14th to 15th in Albany, New York, the Marriott Hotel, 189 Wolf Road. A horror and fantasy con with events, screenings, and guests including Tom Savini, A. Michael Baldwin, Phantasm, Ari Lehman, and a large group of Night of the Living Dead cast members. Killer Con, September 19th to the 22nd, Las Vegas, Nevada, the Stratosphere Hotel Casino. Literary convention with workshops, contests, and celebrity authors David J. Show, John Shirley, and Ray Garten. Horror Realm, September 20th to the 22nd, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Crown Plaza, Pittsburgh South, 164 Fort Coach Road. Annual convention with dealers, celebrities, films, panels, contests, and more. Guests to be announced. Infect Scranton, September 20th to the 22nd, Scranton, Pennsylvania, Montage Mountain, 1000 Montage Mountain Road. Zombie-themed convention and zombie survival race. Vendors, panels, and dead celebrities, including cast members from The Walking Dead, Dawn of the Dead, and Day of the Dead. Shaka Khan, September 20th to the 22nd, Charleston, West Virginia, The Haunted Barn. The latest horror and sci-fi products, professionals, celebrities, including Eugene Clark, Danny Hicks, Doug Jones, Face Off contestants, and Walking Dead cast members, workshops, music, and more. Freaks and Geeks, September 20th to the 22nd, Kalamazoo, Michigan. Candlewood Suites, 3443 Retail Place Drive. Formerly Kalamazoo's Horror Fest, Freaks and Geeks is a horror, sci-fi, and paranormal convention offering everything from celebrity guests including Sid Haig, Robert Zadare, Leanne Curtis, Linnea Quigley, plus contests, vendors, zombie crawls, and more. Jacksonville Festival of Horror, September 21st, Jacksonville, Florida. Brewster's Megaplex, 845 University Boulevard North. New one-day festival with celebrity guests, vendors, artists, costume contests, gaming tournaments, live music, after party, and more. New Orleans Horror Film Festival, September 26th to the 29th, New Orleans, Louisiana. The Inn on Bourbon, corner of Toulouse and Bourbon. Held in the French Quarter, a horror film festival created by horror filmmakers for horror fans. Atlanta Horror Film Festival, September 26th to the 29th, in Atlanta, Georgia. The Goat Farm Art Center. The 7th Annual Atlanta Horror Film Festival presents the very best independent films from across the world. Crypticon, September 27th to the 29th, Bloomington, Minnesota. Doubletree by Hilton, 7800 Normandale Boulevard. Annual HorrorCon with vendors, artists, car show, events, and celebrities including Billy Dee Williams, Adrian Paul, and Daniel Cash. Monster Mania, September 27th to the 29th. Hunt Valley, Maryland. Hunt Valley Inn, 245 Shawan Road. Horror convention with guests, events, and vendors. Guests include Adam West, Burt Ward, David Prowse. Twisted Fears Horror Weekend, September 27th to the 29th, Atlanta, Georgia. Marriott Perimeter City. New horror convention with events, vendors, and guests including Jim Krutt, John Dugan, Camille Keaton, Terry McMinn, R.A. Mihailoff, and Lynn Lowry. Monster Ops, September 27th to the 29th, Schaumburg, Illinois, Renaissance Hotel. New horror convention event with celebrities, vendors, and more. Guests include Claire Coffey from Grimm. MonsterCon, September 28th to the 29th, San Antonio, Texas. Wonderland Mall of the Americas, 4522 Fredericksburg Road. Artists, writers, vendors, zombie contests, Loguli play area, gaming, and more. Ghoultide Gathering, September 28th, Chelsea, Michigan. Chelsea Community Fairgrounds. A magical bazaar of Halloween art featuring celebrated artists from across the country. I'm Miss Mischief, and that's your convention news for the month of September.
The Messerchoops, the power of the crypt.
We'll be right back. 'Twas a long time ago, longer now than it seems, in a place that perhaps you've seen in your dreams. For the story that you are about to be told took place in the holiday worlds of old. Now, you probably wondered where holidays come from. If you haven't, I'd say it's time you begun.
Hi, this is Jeff Davis.
And this is Chris Davis.
We're with the Davis Graveyard, a home haunt in Milwaukee, Oregon. We do a yard display every year. It's kind of a Halloween diorama. We're here to talk about our large-scale props and structures and how we make them.
Right. The process of how we got to where we are now and being able to pull off a 40 by... How big is that, Abby?
13 feet wide.
Three-story Abbey. So yeah. We'll walk you through that process.
So when we first started doing large-scale structures, our facade and our first mausoleum that we built, we started out by building a model just out of foam board, just a small little scale model, and scotch taped it together, just to get an idea of how many panels it was going to take. And then once we knew how many panels it was going to take, then we had an idea how much it was going to cost. So that's kind of how we got started. It's easier to make panels out of 1-inch thick foam. It's half the cost of 2-inch thick.
Right.
We're able to texture it well enough.
And it makes it sturdier if it's backed with a wood frame so that we don't have to worry about panels falling over or blowing over.
All of our panels are built in kind of a theater set construction. So they're 1x3s with half-inch plywood gussets in the corners. And then we glue the foam to the panel, and then we use some EPS plastic washers.
Yeah, from Demand Products.
Get them from Demand Products.
They're meant to put hold styrofoam to wood, so they're specifically for that. I recommend it. It keeps the panels from popping off of the wood from the glue.
Yeah, and we use polyurethane construction adhesive for the glue, so that holds it in place, and the washers just kind of make sure that it doesn't pop off. And then we paint them all black and texture them.
We texture them first. Don't listen to him.
Well, we paint the backs black.
We learned how to paint the backs black on everything just because white. Also, the white doesn't look good. And also, on 1-inch, it's kind of a thin piece of foam if it's white foam. So we make sure we paint the backs black so we don't have so much light showing through on any. We learned that on the first church facade we had where it was up against a wall. And when the lights were on, you could really see through the foam. So we learned our lesson there.
Yeah, so we just paint them all black in the back, and then we texture them using...
whatever tool we happen to feel like using that day. A lot of scouring pads, wire brushes. We've made tools out of nails and pieces of wood. It really just depends. We've used a rake before. It really just depends on what kind of texture you're wanting out of your foam.
Yeah, we use a Dremel Trio to Dremel out grout lines, and then we use all these techniques to texture it, and then we heat gun it all, and then spray it with a exterior latex black paint with a paint sprayer, and then hand sponge the detail on.
And usually what we do when we're building something like the mausoleum and the abbey, we actually put the panels up without anything done to them, up on a frame so we know exactly, so we line them all up. We don't ever try to do a panel like laying them down and saying, oh, we'll fit them all together.
Yeah.
We number them and put them up and then draw the lines on them and then take them down, and that's when we texture them. So it's very important to do that so everything matches up.
Yeah, we use a chalk line and snap lines across multiple panels, and then we draw it all in place with yardsticks and Sharpies so everything lines up. And then we take them down and texture them once we've got all the lines drawn. We label everything in the back. We use just plywood gussets to tie the panels together, and then small little metal brackets for corners.
Right.
And more 1x3s for supports
where
they're needed. We just kind of assemble it. It's very similar to like a theater set construction. We do the same kind of techniques.
Yeah. So the Abbey is quite a feet to put together. It is almost three stories high, and lining up those panels and being able to attach it requires a big wooden frame structure to be built, and then the like one level is attached. We put the whole bottom level up. And now in this particular abbey, now we've two-sided it, so because we wanted the depth. So we basically attach a panel on each side of it and line them all up so the grout lines all match, and then we could put the trim in the middle of it. And then for the upper part of the abbey, we have to rent a scissor lift. We've learned now safety is very important. Ladders are not that safe when you're trying to move big, huge panels over and over and over again. So we've got a, I recommend it if you're going to do something that big to get a scissor lift or something very stable to stand on while you're working on them and put the panels up.
Our local rental place doesn't even charge us for delivery and pickup, and they give us a pretty good discount on the rental of a scissor lift for the day. So a 15-foot little scissor lift really isn't that expensive, and it's worth the money as opposed to buying several large ladders and
right.
And the risk of hurting yourself.
Yeah, nothing makes you feel old than the guy in the rental place going, I used to go to your place when I was a kid. That's why you're getting the discount. I guess it's kind of worth it.
Yeah. So, yeah, like Chris said, with the abbey, the new abbey, it's a freestanding structure made out of 2x4s and 4x4s. And then we attach the panels to it. We used to, the old cathedral, we attached the structure and scaffolding to the side of the building and then attached that. The freestanding one's a lot nicer because it's easy to get around and get it all connected up.
It's something we learned from doing the church facade, the original facade we had, was we now don't attach any trim pieces to the panels permanently. Everything is done by magnet so it can come off. So we don't have different levels or heights or widths of panels. All the panels are exactly the same, and all the trim goes, it can be packed away somewhere, and it's just long strips with rare earth magnets or magnets stolen from hard drives that pop all of the trim on that facade so that everything is the same width. That is very, it's like one of the, it's time consuming, but trust me, for the storage and just keeping the thing from not getting damaged, it's one of the better things we've ever learned.
Yeah, all the add-on accents, skulls, or multi-layered panels or trim pieces, we just do that all with magnets and then separate those pieces out later so the panels just are nice and flat and easy to store.
Yeah, especially if you've got a piece of trim that goes over multiple panels, because it's really hard to, you don't really want to cut your trim piece. So you just basically take the trim piece, that was Dory visiting, and just make the pieces so they fit on, so after the structure is up. I guess the cat's going to help with the interview. I think that's probably one of our better tricks, I'd say, is the magnets. Go to whatever hard, there's got to be like a, in your town, some recycling place for electronic equipment, and you can probably get hard drives for almost nothing, or find an IT person that's got a bunch of them. And
there's a couple of rare earth magnet online,
yeah, there
places
are those
too. You can buy them in the tubes. They're really inexpensive. Mm-hmm. You can buy a whole bunch of them, and just two or three magnets per piece hold things on really well.
Yeah.
And we just use metal plates on the panels so that they can attach.
Yeah, just like those little metal plate pieces that you get at Home Depot for like doing fencing and wood construction, kind of for holding corners and stuff together. Those are the pieces we use. We buy different ones. We shape them and bend them to however we need them, or glue them onto a panel if we need to.
Yeah. All that stuff is that strong tie metal bracketing stuff you can get at Home Depot for a few cents a piece.
And then a very important factor of this is make a lot of friends, because it takes about 10 to 12 people to put that abbey up in a weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And people aren't afraid of heights, because driving around in a scissor lift is not for the faint of heart. Especially if you spend some time up there when you're putting in the insert pieces, like of all the windows and stuff, have all these rounded or gothic arches in them. So somebody's going to spend hours in there up there fitting each one in. Labeling is really important, so you know which piece of trim goes with which window. So everything is labeled on the back. If you do paint it, we put a piece of tape over the where the number is, spray it black, and then pull the tape off. So it goes one little white area that'll say, like, you know, panel 6, window left, you know, that kind of stuff, label it. And then keep aren't very official about how we do it, but we keep a sort of a piece of foam pretty much at this point that just says which panel goes where and what they're numbered, and just some kind of, you know, written down would probably be better, but we can sometimes we just wing it, just so you can remember next time when you take it apart. I'd also recommend taking pictures of everything while it's going up and while it's coming down, so that later when you're referencing putting stuff up, so like, how exactly did we do that? At least for us, we have so many pieces, it's always good to have a record of how things went up, come up, and go down.
The first couple times you do it, it's real important, but I mean, after you've done it for 2 or 3 years, then you pretty much know what you're doing. But the first year after you take it down, it's really good to document it real well, so the next year you can remember exactly how you did it, so you can put it all back up again. That's probably all our tips that we can think of for building large structures. Everything's made out of 4x8 panels. So, like Chris said, the Abbey's 2 8-foot panels stacked on top of each other, plus a 4-foot panel for the very, very top. So it's 20 feet tall at the peak. And that's about as high as we would normally go for something like that. And again, we just hook everything together with gussets and 1x3 support systems in the back to keep it all together. But if you think about your panels just being 4 foot by 8 foot is the maximum size you can get a sheet of foam, then you build everything out of that. And smaller, cut it down smaller if you need to do smaller panels. That's how we did the mausoleum.
Right.
And then put structures, pieces of plywood where you need strength. Like for the steps of our mausoleum, we put plywood underneath the foam so that nobody steps through it anymore. And for freestanding stuff like columns, we'll just make them out of stacked up foam glued together and shaped. But and those just come apart and set aside somewhere. But I think that's all I can think of for tips for building large
perfect
structures.
Pieces. Yeah, just a lot of time, money, and a lot of friends.
Yeah.
And our stuff is definitely, when you take on something like the Abbey, we really realistically had to tell ourselves, and this we knew when we started it would be 3 years before it was done, and this is its third year, so this is its, it will probably be as done as it's going to be, because we knew that realistically, if that would be the only project we could do, and we probably couldn't have even finished it in a year, just financially, crew-wise, it's, everybody likes to do different things, and when you're all working on one particular project, we're all on top of each other, so we've learned to let people work on multiple things. So when you're thinking a large structure, definitely give yourself the time. It doesn't always have to be done this year, and you do learn some things when it's up and realize, okay, next, when we go to work the next phase of it, we'll do this to it.
Yeah, and you never really know what it's going to look like till it's up in the yard and you get a good look at it with everything else there and it's all lit, and then you can kind of make adjustments the next year and make the changes you want to make and add to it or subtract from it.
Well, thanks, guys.
Sure, thanks. Hope this helps.
To become a werewolf. Ingredients: chalk or string, 1 iron vessel, 1 iron tripod. Any 3 of the following: asafoetida, parsley, opium, henbane, saffron, aloe, poppy seed, or solanum. 1 freshly killed cat, aniseed, camphor, opium, 1 wolfskin girdle. Preparation. Go to a solitary place at midnight when the moon is new and strong, preferably a desert, the woods, or a mountaintop. On perfectly level ground, mark off with the chalk or string a circle with a radius of at least 7 feet, and inside this, a circle with a radius of 3 feet. In the center, boil water in an iron vessel on the iron tripod. As the water boils, throw in handfuls of the 3 spices, meanwhile intoning, "Spirits from the deep who never sleep, be kind. Spirits from the grave, without a soul to save, be kind. Spirits of the trees that grow upon the leaves, be kind. Spirits of the air, foul and black, not fair, be kind. Water spirits hateful to ships and bathers faithful, be kind to me. Spirits of earthbound death that glide with noiseless tread, be kind to me. Spirits of heat and fire destructive in your ire, be kind to me. Spirits of cold and ice, patrons of crime and vice, be kind to me. Wolves, vampires, satyrs, ghosts, elect of all the devilish hosts, I pray you send hither, send hither, send hither the great gray shape that makes men shiver, shiver, shiver.
removing your upper garments, smear your body with the fat of the freshly killed cat, mixed with aniseed, camphor, and opium. Bind your loins with the wolf's skin and kneel down within the middle of the smaller circle to await the unknown. The unknown will appear or make its presence felt when the fire burns blue and quickly dies out.
I'm Mr. Chicken, and you're entering my Hall of Illusions. Since this is your first visit, I'm going to start by sharing some tips and tricks to getting the most out of projection effects. I'm going to talk about choosing a projector, hiding the secret of your effect, video playback options, alignment of projection effects, and a few other tricks I've picked up in my experiments. I've been making my own projection effects since 2007, when I animated Davy Jones from the Pirates of the Caribbean appearing on the sail of my pirate ship. The next 2 years I made and updated a recreation of Madame Leota from the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland. You may have read my how-to. In 2012 I developed my Haunted Tombstone projection effects, and just last month I released Sybil the Clairvoyant, an update, and dare I say, improvement, upon my old Madame Leota. Projection effects are a great thing for home and professional haunters alike. Not all videos and setups are cheap, but they're high impact, have a low storage footprint, and are very easy to set up. So, let's say you've made or purchased a projection video. The first question most people have next is, what projector should I use? I don't want to get too specific on this because, like any electronic item, the products available change frequently. But there are basically three types of projectors from a haunter's perspective. They are toy projectors, pocket projectors, and real projectors. If my choice of words didn't clue you in yet, the real projectors are your best bet. These are the office and home theater models that are the brightest and have the best picture quality. Pocket projectors, sometimes called Pico projectors, are aimed at office work and are usually meant to be plugged into an iPod or something similar. I use the terms pocket and Pico interchangeably, but some companies differentiate between the two. They're much, much less bright than a good office or home theater projector, but they tend to be designed decently and will put out a nice picture as long as there isn't too much light around them. Last are the toy projectors. Now, I have a fondness for these because they're really inexpensive, usually well under $100. Although they're as dim or dimmer than a pocket projector, and the image isn't nearly as consistent, they will work for haunt use. Now, if you have a pocket or toy projector, you'll get the best results if the projector is no more than maybe 3 or 4 feet from the projection surface. This means you'll want to use those for smaller effects, since the screen size won't be as large. A real office or home theater projector gives you many more options. If you're serious about projection effects, look on eBay for used projectors. Try to find one that's at least 1,000 lumens, that's the measure of brightness, and make sure the lamp has many hours left on it. Often, those are more expensive to replace than the projector itself. If you find one you're interested in, look it up on projectorcentral.com for all the specs and to make sure that it will work with the other equipment you have. It's also good for comparing different projectors. Now, does everyone have their projector? Great. Now we can move on to the fun things. When you use a digital projector, there's no such thing as blackness. There's always light passing through every part of the image, so what's black on the video will actually show up as gray on the projected image. So, let's say you're doing a facial projection. Better yet, let's say you're using my Sybil the Clairvoyant effect. There's a face in the middle of the video and a black space around it. But when you set it up with your projector, that black space shows as a gray box on the wall behind her and can give away the illusion. Fortunately, there's an easy fix. Basically, you're going to create soft shadows that blur the edges out into true blackness. Here's the simplest way to do it. Grab some strips of cardboard. They don't need to be more than a few inches wide and long. What you're going to do is use these strips to build a board with a rectangular opening for the projection to pass through, but just barely clip off the edges to fade them away. If your projector is on a table, this is easy. Just start by taping the first strip down maybe 4 to 6 inches in front of the projector, so it cuts off just the bottom of the projection. Play with the distance and height to get it to where you feel the edge is not so noticeable, but not so much that it cuts into the image you're trying to project, the face in my example. Then tape 2 more strips to that bottom piece going vertically to make the sides of the rectangle, again making slight adjustments until you like how it looks. Do the same with a strip across the top, and you should now have nice feathered edges to your projection. If you want to make it more circular, you can use this new rectangle as a template, remembering its distance from the projector, or adding small pieces around the corners. It's much easier to create the gobo, as it's called in theater, this way than by trial and error of cutting different sized holes in a piece of board. Now, how do you get your video to play? The nature of the effect will probably decide this for you. Some effects, like my haunted tombstone, Sybil the Clairvoyant, also the Ghost Steps by VexFX and D Minor's Ghost Maid, exist in a world of their own, more or less disregarding haunt patrons. Playing one of these videos on a continuous loop is not only the easiest way to use them, but it's how they were designed. For effects that don't come on looping DVDs, you can either burn the video to a looping DVD yourself. In iDVD, you just drag and drop the video file into the application, select it, click the Advanced menu, select Loop Video, click Burn, and you'll have your looping DVD ready in half an hour. Or you can play the files off a digital video playback device like an iPod, a laptop, or a more professional video or media player where you have the option of playing in a loop. Other projection effects you might want to trigger from your other control systems. If you're using VSA for an animatronics routine, the new Pro or Ultimate versions of the software allow you to sync a video with the routine, so your projection effect could interact with your animatronics. Also, Mike Fox's Night Frights offers a device that will allow a DVD to be triggered when a sensor is tripped. You can also trigger other props from your projection video. Back in 2009, I edited the audio track of my Madame Leota, so the left channel had her voice going through a speaker, and the right channel had nothing but audio tones that I played through a scary Terry board to trigger a fog machine in the cauldron next to her. The witch's brew would flare up whenever she said an incantation. Hi-Res Designs offers a circuit board that interprets the DTMF signals embedded in their videos to trigger relays. The effect can be much like my cruder Scary Terry setup, but because the signals are the same as what your telephone uses to dial a number, multiple different props can be triggered from the same DTMF track. It's pretty spiffy, but a little more to wrap your head around initially. Alignment of projection effects is very important. I'm going to start with a simple example. Pretend you've got a hollow window you're setting up in your front room. You want the image to cover the whole window and not be skewed off to one side, tilted, or at a distorted angle, right? The picture would look weird. Once you get into more advanced projection effects, as you can imagine, this matters even more. When, for example, you set up the projector for my haunted tombstone effect, it's best to have the image of the tombstone go slightly beyond the foam tombstone you cut out, so there's no end to the projected image on the projection surface. You also want to have the projector pointed pretty straight on. Pretty basic, right? Now, let's say you're setting up a facial projection, like Sybil the Clairvoyant. You really have to be careful that your projector is pointed straight at the head form, that it's at the right height, that it's pointed at just the right place on the head. Looking at the placement of the projected nostrils on the nose is a good way to check this when you're doing facial effects. If those get off, things start looking really wonky. It's like if you took your skin and slid it around on your face. Weird stuff. But again, if you make the projection go ever so slightly bigger than the form you're trying to project on, you tend to get the best results. Of course, you don't want to get too big because then you'll be projecting sort of a outline of the effect onto the space behind it, which is also not what you want. There are no formulas for this. It's really all about taking your time and making things look as good to your eye as you can. One last quick tip. I figured out that you can use these little $4 cell phone wide-angle lenses from eBay or Amazon to make your pocket or toy projector have a wider angle. It lets you put the projector closer to the projection surface, which makes some difference when the projector is as dim as those ones. For $4, it's worth playing with. I'd say it made the image of mine about 50% larger. That'll do it for this time. This is Mr. Chicken, and I'll see you next time in my Hall of Illusions.
The Messerchoops. Dracula hates photo shoots.
This is Dr. Mithsonian, otherwise known as Mike Melillo. I'm a makeup and special effects instructor at the Robert Fiance Makeup Academy in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. I've been asked to talk to you today about Halloween props and makeup, which is a tough thing to do because it's a visual medium, but I'm going to do the best I can. Today's topic, fast weatherproof hands. These are hands that I think I came up with only because I've never seen them before. If someone else came up with them, let them have the credit. Meanwhile, here's the recipe for them. You're going to need 1 gallon of liquid latex. I like to use latex. You could probably use monster mud for this too, if that's what you have on hand, but I prefer liquid latex because it just looks similar to the makeup and the rubber that your mask head is probably made from, and they look more like flesh to me. Anyway, you need 1 gallon of latex or monster mud. You need a sheet of 3/16, which is just about 1/4 inch, foam core board. They sell it in 15 by 20 sizes, which you can get about a dozen hands out of. I like to use the solid black foam core. Number one, it's a little cheaper than the white. Number two, it bends easier because the foam in it is black and it has some other property that lets it be folded in a nice manner. But you can use white or any other color because you're going to paint the thing in the end anyway. I like to use what I have on hand, so use what you have on hand, but I prefer the black foam core. You're going to need your hand, the opposite hand that you're working with. Don't worry, you could always flip it over and use it for two hands, you see? It's the same template for both, and you're going to take that hand and lay it on the foam core. Make sure you have about 2 or 3 inches of forearm on the foam board as well, because you're going to want to use that too, because this will help you later on attach the hand to your prop armature, and it just makes it easier to position the wrist. Now, advanced haunters may want to take some floral wire and run it down the palm side of these hands after you cut them out, but I don't see the need for it. It's over what you need to do. The foam core and the combination of what you're going to do to it is going to be more than enough to hold these things together. So, trace out your hand in a natural position. Make sure that your fingertips are about an inch apart. Don't worry about posing at this point. Just lay your hand flat down like you're making those Halloween turkeys in kindergarten and trace it out. Don't forget about 2 or 3 inches of arm from the wrist down to, don't forget to accommodate for that too. Otherwise, you're just going to have a hand that sits there. And you want to trace that out. Don't worry about accuracy at this point because you're going to go back now and you're going to augment it. If it's a gorilla hand, you may want to make the fingers a little wider than your fingers. If it's a, you know, a zombie hand with long claws, you may want to just draw in some claws. It's all up to you at this point. Now, when you do draw in the claws or the nails, you know, you're going to want to take the pen cap from that pen, and you're going to want to go on the back side of the hand where the nail beds would be, and you want to just sort of score in a little indentation into the foam core there. That helps to bring that nail to the surface. You know, it just helps a little bit to sculpt. It's a sculptural thing, and I just like to do it. It adds a dimension to the thing. Now turn the hand over, and starting from the knuckle, go and run a lengthwise score, again with the pen cap, all the way down the length of the fingertips on each of the fingers and the thumb. This is going to help you because we're going to fold from the other side. But before you do that, also score in some lines going down the palm from the fingers to the wrist. This is going to mimic sort of the arc of the hand. You see, most hands are sort of a ovoid shape or a convex shape, and we're going to bend toward that. Also, cut across with your pen cap, and again, just indent it. Don't worry about breaking the paper. You really don't want to, but if you do break the paper or the foam core, it's okay. Do it at the wrist. Do it at all of the finger joints. And get started. Turn it back over, and now bend the finger joints into the positions that you want, starting with the knuckle and working your way down, and do all of the fingers and sort of experiment with it. You're going to also want to push the palm upward and hold the sides of the hand so that you get, again, a convex sort of shape to the back of the palm. This all adds to the dimension of the product. These things look way better than just gorilla hands sitting on something too. Once you get them done, now once you have the fingers bent in the positions you like, you want to go in between the finger joints and squeeze the foam core down again toward the bottom or the palm side of the foam core, and squeeze in between each of the finger joints. This brings out a beautiful knuckle joint in between each of the fingers, and it really looks cool. Now you can bend the fingers again and really put them into shape, get them the way you want them, dip them in the latex all the way in, let them sit there a minute, let them soak it up a little, take them out, and you're going to want to put a clip on them and maybe hang them to dry. You could always go back and dip in the other end and, you know, seal the thing up completely once it's dry, and now you have fast latex weatherproof hands. Go in on them with acrylics or a mix of acrylics and latex, or use your latex house paint, whatever the heck it is you're going to use. Paint them up, make them look as realistic as possible, add fake nails to the top if you like, or, you know, whatever. Sometimes you can augment them with other pieces of foam core, little scraps of foam core on the top to indicate tendons, and you may want to build up the knuckles a little more with some more foam core and do a second dip. It's going to look fantastic, it's going to look dimensional, and it's going to last for years. I've used the same pair on any number of different props that I've made, and every year they just keep on going. They're weatherproof, they're not going to fall apart, they're not going to crack, they're just fantastic. Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Again, this is Dr. Mithsonian saying, every day is Halloween.
Hiya, kids. It's me, your friend, Grandpa. I gotta tell you, I am starting a new club, and I want you to join. It's called the Junior Vampires of America. I mean, you'll hear scary monster stories. Now, to call, you gotta ask your parents' permission and call this phone number, 1-900-909-4300. You'll hear all about my monster friends, learn how to get a free vampire patch, and a list of special vampire tricks and secrets. So call 1-900-909-4300. Learn how to scare your friends, even yourself. Join Grandpa's Junior Vampires of America Club, and I will make you a junior vampire.
Hey, kids, call 1-900-909-4300. That's 1-900-909-4300 to hear Grandpa's scary stories and join the Junior Vampires Club. Just $2 a first minute, 45 cents each additional. Ask Mom or Dad first.
Haunting interviews.
Pull me this tender morsel. Disturbing red muckle bone dress.
Jack, they call me Jack, ma'am.
What a fine fat boy you are, Jack.
You don't really mean to eat me, do you, ma'am?
Oh, indeed I do!
First, I just want to thank you, Rob, for being the first interview on Fright Radio. And for all the listeners tuning in, this is Rob Cometti of Mucklebones LLC. So welcome to the show, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
And you know, I've been following your stuff for a while online, and you know, I see everything that you post on Facebook. And I think actually even prior to Facebook, I came across the Mucklebones website. So I got to see a lot of what you were doing. And you know, what basically got you into Halloween and home haunting? I see the references to Meg Mucklebones, so I'm guessing Legend was a favorite of yours. Was it movies or something else?
Well, you know, it like most people who get into this industry, it started at a very young age, really centered around trick-or-treat time. And, you know, I kind of first discovered my passion after setting up some Halloween displays at the house, and you know, really wanted to stay home more than go trick-or-treating, because it was more fun setting things up at the house than actually going out door to door. I think one of the first displays I remember setting up was I think I took one of my old Ben Cooper costumes. I think it was a Yoda. And it was my previous year costume, so I had a new costume that year, but I still kept the, you know, the old Yoda one. And I dressed up our mailbox as Yoda.
Oh, no way.
And yeah, just watched the reaction of people as they came by, and you know, people would look at this crudely built figure, and you know, I was really getting a kick out of, you know, the reaction I was getting.
Was he handing out, or did he have a bowl of candy in his hand or anything, or was it just?
No, I think he was just there. And it, you know, what's even worse about it is, you know, it wasn't even like a street side mailbox. It was up against the house.
Oh, geez.
So it was literally just the mask draped on the mailbox, and then the Ben Cooper plastic costume hanging down.
Gotcha. So from that very moment, that was it the reaction that you got? Was it something that just made you say, well, now next year I want to ramp it up a little bit more, do something different? And I mean, did it keep on growing year after year?
Absolutely, and it's funny because it's still growing.
Still growing.
Yeah, each year I would keep each costume, And I would just start building up a collection of props and costumes. And, last year's costume became this year's display. And it just kept growing, and it grew into a yard haunt.
Yeah.
That took over, the entire front yard and the driveway and the garage, which was always a lot of fun. I mean, you miss out on trick or treat, but I was getting to the age, and I was getting bigger to where I looked too big in a costume.
but I think that's how most of us haunters are, right? I mean, you kind of have to forfeit, going out trick or treating. For the haunt, it's almost a love of doing it and seeing the expression of everybody else coming by, checking out what you're doing. So,
and from there, I did the yard haunt for several years, just with family and friends, and it got to be pretty big. As most home haunters will know, you get the cars lining up, and of course you run out of candy, but the candy becomes secondary to people going through, your home haunt, and. So that lasted for several years, and I remember one instance of, and this was, I think, when I was still in high school, we set up, it was getting so big that I couldn't set it up in one night. So I set it up the night before, and I enclosed the entire front yard in 8-foot cardboard walls and had a walk-through cemetery. And the next morning, I went out to catch the school bus. Because unfortunately, the Halloween fell on a school day that year, and all the cardboard walls had the morning dew had gotten to them, so everything had just sagged and collapsed.
Oh, no.
So my whole enclosed cemetery was destroyed, and luckily my folks didn't make me go to school that day, so I spent the day repairing it and bringing the cemetery back to life for that night's trick or treat. But
And how old were you? How long ago was this? Like, this was when you were...
I was in high school by that time.
Okay.
And that was probably one of the last years that we did the home haunt, because it was just getting to the point where it was just too big. And, it was kind of time to move on to the next best thing.
So, was the next best thing the Mucklebones Monster Museum? I assume that was a few years after high school or down the line, but I read a little bit about that, being kind of a direction that you were going. You were building these props, so...
Actually, before Mucklebones, I got involved with a community theater that was doing a, fundraising haunted houses.
Okay.
And I joined their design team. It was very, very... I say that that's kind of a lofty title, but it was, sketches on paper. And we did something called the Fright Factory in Ohio, and that went on for, I want to say, maybe 4 years or so.
Okay.
And I did the design work for them, and at that time I had quite a collection of costumes and masks that I would lend them for the season, and help them build props, and it was a lot of fun. It was a great learning experience on kind of the business end of running a haunt.
Yeah,
and I did that for probably 3 or 4 years, and it was a lot of fun, but it was also frustrating because we were dealing with everyone was volunteers, so none of the workers were paid. It was all just if you could show up and if you could make it, and at times there was only 2 or 3 people running the entire haunt, so as we're taking people through it, you felt a little bad that. These people are paying the same price and only getting 2 or 3 people jumping out at them. And on other nights, it could be, 15 to 20. So it was very sporadic, and that was very frustrating for me.
And then this led you into the Monster Museum.
It did. As I was collecting all these Halloween costumes, I started to get into the collector busts.
Okay.
And, high-end latex masks and resin busts. And while the costumes were used for, the business end, like the haunts, the latex collector masks and the resin busts were part of my personal collection. So they weren't used in a haunt. They were just, treasured collectibles. So anyways, after, you know, a couple of frustrating years with the volunteers, I decided I'd like to do my own haunted attraction, but how can I do it without all these people? I know it takes a lot of people to put one on.
Yeah.
And I knew that I wouldn't be able to pay people, and then I was back to square one with, you know, getting volunteers. So I had a few friends that were doing similar type things, but they were walk-through wax museums, which I've always loved since I was a kid.
Yeah. We have a great one in the city. It's Madame Sod's. I think that's how you're saying it, in New York City.
Yeah,
you're familiar with that one. And they do a great Halloween show as well. They, you know, the whole entire place turns into a walk-through attraction, and it's great. I love seeing that realistic kind of. I mean, they really do. They look so real that you can just, you know, you would think they really are the same people. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've seen the one in New York. It's amazing. I haven't been to their After Dark Halloween event.
Yeah.
But it looks fantastic, though.
So you decided that this was the direction that you wanted to take it to doing the museum. So can you explain a little bit the process of starting that, you know, opening it, and what was it really like to be in there? I mean, are you still doing it today even?
Yeah, so the way it started was I started taking these collectible busts that I had at home and building full bodies for them. And, you know, at that time, there was no budget, absolutely no budget. So literally I was going to dumpsters and behind carpet stores and getting those big carpet tubes.
Yeah.
And I was getting those and building figures out of those. And I was taking the leftover carpet padding that they would discard, you know, after they would do a job, but they would have leftover carpet padding that was scraps. So I would take the carpet tubes and the carpet padding, and I was building figures because I had no money.
Yeah.
So
that's a true haunter right there. We don't have any money in our pockets. It's whatever you can find laying around, try to make it look as great as you can.
Exactly. So I built, you know, some of my first figures. Actually, my entire first museum was mainly out of carpet tubes.
Wow.
Yeah, there were no mannequins. It was all just whatever I could find and piece together.
What was holding the tubes together to form the body?
There were various things. Sometimes I would bolt them together.
Okay.
And just use, you know, big lag bolts and washers so it wouldn't rip through. Other times I would be very creative with the duct tape. But it really taught me a lot about, you know, the anatomically the body and form, and, you know, you can't just throw a piece of padding on a carpet tube and it make it look like a human. You really gotta kind of bend it and fold it and create kind of like shoulders and muscles and bellies and backs. So I think that starting off that way was a. You know, I probably wouldn't change it because it was a great learning experience. I still use some of that stuff today as far as what I learned back then.
So you didn't have any prior experience, or you didn't go to school for art or industrial design or anything like that. Was it just basically learning on your own?
It was mainly learning on my own, because through high school, you know, you don't really get to choose a whole lot. You know, back then, what you take, it's, you know, you get all the basics. When I did get into college, I went to Ohio State, and I did take some sculpting classes. That was mostly in clay and metal.
Okay.
So I did have some formal training in that, and that is actually what my degree is in. I'm a Bachelor of Arts in sculpting. But from the time I started building these full-size figures, I was kind of showing them off to people and got some great reactions. And I said, this is my outlet. This is my way of doing a haunt with no people. You know, I can run this haunt with one person if I build these monsters. So I opened Mucklebones Monster Museum, I think when I was 21, I remember correctly. And, what we did is we had a local festival in my hometown, in the downtown area, that opened in September. And what I did is I rented out some building space, and I did a preview show in September, and then gave out coupons and told people about, hey, if you, you know, you come back in October, we'll be here, but we'll add, you know, so many more displays, so you can come back in October and see more. And that turned out great. I mean, it was a great learning experience. I think I only had 16 figures total the first year we did that.
And your figures, you were also creating scenes for the figures to be in, or were they just simply the figures themselves?
No, it's there were scenes too. I mean, I use that word loosely. It was whatever I could find. I mean, literally, I had a Jekyll, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde.
Okay.
I had a Mr. Hyde figure, and his bookshelves behind him, you know, were filled with books and lab jars and everything. But the bookcase was made out of carpet tubes.
Oh, you really went the haunted route. I applaud you for that.
I was the Fred Sanford of
Waxman. How was the turnout that very first year?
You know, it was good. I kind of had a captive audience for the festival because there was already thousands of people downtown. You know, it was tough. It was slow for October though, because I was relying just on, you know, kind of word of mouth, a little bit of marketing, and just people driving by.
Yeah.
And I would just dress up on the corner like a vampire, and people would drive by and even stop and say, you know, what is this? And I have to tell them. And it was rough, you know, that first year. But after the first year, you know, then you've got history behind you. So
yeah,
there's something that people can, you know, relate to. And, you know, they remember from the year before. But I did the Wax Museum in Ohio for 4 years. Up until I graduated college, I believe. Wow.
So this went on for a while, and did it eventually stop? And where is it at today? Are you still doing it today?
Yeah, it stopped in 1999, I believe, and then I relocated to Florida, and most of the stuff really stayed up in Ohio in storage because I just didn't have any room down in Florida to store it. So in 2000, and actually in 2000, I landed a gig decorating a martini bar for Halloween. And they just kind of wanted it themed out so people had some, you know, something else to do other than haunted houses. So they could go to their haunted house, and after the haunted house, they could come to this martini bar that was kind of tricked out with some life-size figures and a Frankenstein's lab. So that's kind of where I shifted my focus. I kind of put the museum in storage for a while.
Is that kind of where Mucklebones LLC started to take shape, and you decided props can be the thing I do?
Yeah, it kind of morphed into this, the museum, like I said, the museum kind of went into storage, and it morphed into this kind of decor slash rental side business that has kept me busy, you know, since 2000.
Wow. So is Mucklebones, is this your bread and butter now? Is this all that you're focusing on?
It's really just a side job for me.
Yeah.
It's all freelance, and what it really is now is it's still rentals, and I'll rent from my personal collection now too. Depending on what the event is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very particular about, you know, where these things go, because they're still my babies.
Yeah, it's hard. I can see that right there. I know I talked to you a little bit about your creature from the Black Lagoon, and it's just spot on. I can see how hard it would be to part with anything like that. But I'm sure any collector out there, you know, would love to have it in his or her man cave or woman cave.
Right. So, what I do mainly now is I'll do seasonal decor, whether it's restaurants, clubs, bars. I've done professional offices before, residential parties. So I'll do all that. But then also throughout the year is I do custom props and full-size figures for collectors or just fans. And then I've also been doing over the last year and a half some local conventions. I'll go in and they'll provide me space and I'll set up Muckle Bones again just for the weekend.
Any particular conventions that any of us haunters out there might be attending that we would know of, or we can come and check you out?
Yeah, the last ones I've done, and I try to keep it pretty close because moving this stuff, this isn't easy to move all this stuff.
No.
And I don't like to go too far with it, but I've been doing the Spooky Empire shows in Orlando.
Okay.
And they do two shows a year. They do one in May called Mayhem, and then they do another in October called the Ultimate Horror Weekend. And I've been doing walkthrough museums and also celebrity stage setups for them. So where they, you know, normally have their Q&A with the couches and they interview the celebrities. For their last event, I set their stage up like a Frankenstein's laboratory.
Oh.
So, yeah, so they had a full backdrop to all their celebrities, which made for some great photo ops.
So you're doing the conventions now, and Muckle Bones is going strong. I'm just curious about the actual creation now of all these characters that you're doing. Obviously, you've progressed since you were in high school doing the, you know, the Haunt and Yoda on the Mailbox to what you're doing today. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, your process, you know, what types of materials you're using, you know, for the life-size characters, anything that us haunters, you know, would actually be able to benefit from, like just advice?
Yeah, sure. Basically, what the niche that I fill is I'm in the middle, really, for the haunt industry. There's and nothing against the spirit stores, but that's kind of a mass-produced, you know, the Halloween outlets, and that's great for what it is. But for people looking for something a little more high-end that don't necessarily have, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars to drop on a full-size figure, I'm kind of in that middle ground. And I'm able to do that because I find and use things that are already existing. So if someone contacts me for a specific figure, and I'll give you my most recent example, is I did a Tar Man from Return of the Living Dead.
Yes, I saw that one.
And that was a blast to do because he's one of my favorite zombies. And what I was able to do is I knew that there was already a head that had been sculpted in the 90s. And so I was able to get the head. I knew where I could get zombie hands, zombie back, zombie chest, zombie knees, zombie feet. So all that stuff already existed, and I was able to get it, repaint it, customize it, and then put it on a posable body and you know, do it for a lot less than it would have cost someone to do it from the ground up sculpting it.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as construction-wise, I still use a lot of everything. I don't use carpet tubes anymore. some of them, you know, it really depends on what the figure is.
Yeah.
For example, a few years ago, I did a, like an almost a 9 foot tall Meg Muckle Bones, a witch for a bar.
Yeah.
And I've come to learn that whenever you do something for a bar or a restaurant, a club, that has so many people in it, everything has to be larger than life and very tall.
Mm-hmm.
So this Meg Muckle Bones was very tall, so she could be seen over the crowds. You're not getting your money's worth if you make a 6 foot tall figure and the place gets packed and nobody sees it.
Yeah.
So you have to have something that's taller than normal humans. Well, you can't just go get a mannequin for something like that. The whole thing was built out of wood and foam. So I would just do a little stick figure sketch on paper and then decide from that stick figure sketch how long each stick should be. And then that's what became almost the skeleton. Is I would decide, okay, the torso needs to be, you know, 40 inches. So I would cut my board at 40 inches and then I would bolt it to the shoulders, which were, 48 inches. You know, I'm just making all this up right now.
Yeah.
But you kind of start with your little stick figure and the pose that you want, and then you know, use a little math and start to measure it out. And then once you have your stick figure done in wood in life, then you can start adding the foam to it. And I just go out and get the foam that you put on the top of your bed, like that egg crate foam.
Yeah.
And I'll buy that in the big king size sheets. And you just cut it, you know, however big you need it, wrap it around the legs. And you, if you're using wood, you can just staple it right into the wood.
Mm-hmm.
I also, what I'll do to create muscle is I'll use like twine. So after the foam is on the structure, I'll use twine to maybe make a knee or make it look more like a thigh. So I'll make it tighter towards the top and tighter towards the knee, so it kind of billows out into a thigh.
Okay.
Same thing with like a belly, is I'll kind of fold and tuck the foam under so it sticks out more like a belly.
So how long did the Meg Muckle bones that you made for the bar, what was the length of time that it took you? How many hours were you putting into that?
That probably took me, you know, most of my stuff is done on the weekends, and it probably took me maybe 3 weekends to do.
Yeah.
It actually goes pretty quick if I have all the pieces and parts in front of me. You know, if I have to make something from scratch, you know, like a pair of hands or something, you know, that just takes so much longer. But if I have everything, costume and everything in front of me, you know, I could do it in a day if I was focused.
And that's the hardest thing, is keeping us haunters focused, right? I often have all these plans written down, and I tell my friends that every single day, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do this, and I end up doing maybe one thing every weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the way it always is. But for some of the other figures that are kind of more on the life size, the human size, if you can get a hold of a great-looking mannequin, that's really the way to go. Especially for transporting, you can pop them apart. You know, I would say if you can find a secondhand mannequin that doesn't look like a fashion mannequin, because that's the worst, is
yeah.
to dress up a monster and he's got his hands on his hips. But there's also ways to, you know, customize those. You can always cut the arms and, you know, reposition them, which I've done many times. But what I also like to use a lot of is what I call like a dressmaker bust form.
Okay.
And you'll find those a lot in like a men's suit department, where it's just a torso that doesn't have a head, but it has possibly posable arms, you know, that you put a suit on.
Yeah.
Especially for characters that don't have legs. Like if you got someone that's wearing a gown or a dress.
Like if you were going to do a witch or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You don't need the legs. All you really need is the torso.
Yeah.
I have a Bride of Frankenstein in my museum here at my house, and she's just a torso with a pole that goes to the ground. Because you don't need to see her legs or her feet, because you never do.
So you have a museum also set up in your house as well?
I do. I have a that's actually where Muckle Bones resides when it's not in use. We have a walk-through museum in the house.
I hope you're going to give me a tour one day. I'm going to have to come over to Florida down your way and check this out.
Yeah, absolutely. And I use it as a place to, you know, store my collection, because it's all set up with stage lighting and you know, mood lighting. But I also bring clients over who are interested in either you know, decorating for a job, or if they're looking for a life-size figure, I'll bring them over here, and it's kind of like a showroom.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
It's my stuff, and it's not for sale. It's for rent, but it's, you know, I can walk them through, and they can see the things, because pictures just don't, it's not the same seeing it in pictures.
Yeah.
So I'll bring them through, and I have a little sound system hooked up that they can kind of walk through and see everything, and then we have, you know, a table set up that we can look at designs or plans.
Well, for the listeners that are tuning in right now to hear this interview, maybe we can get a few pictures of your showroom to put on the Fright Radio blog. Maybe they can check it out themselves, too. And who knows, maybe some of them will be future clients of yours.
Oh, absolutely. No problem.
That'd be great. So, all in all, what does the future of Muckle Bones, what do you see it being or becoming? Or is, you know, are you growing towards anything? You know, what's your future hold?
Well, you know, as most haunters know, it's, you don't quit your day job.
No.
always keep the day job. So, I still, you know, have a full-time job, and this is really a part-time thing that really it supports itself. And I say that meaning this started off as a collection for me. But this hobby isn't cheap, as you probably know.
Absolutely.
So it pays for itself. And I'll continue to do it because I'm continuing to buy things for my collection. you know, I sell one thing, I buy another thing. So, I'd like to see it expand. I'd like to see it get a little bigger. I can't take on a ton of work, so I'm very selective for what I do. I'm not a big business. I'm a one-man show with help from my family and friends.
And how does the family and friends, what do they think of Muckle Bones and the hours you put into it?
I mean, they're great. They're very accepting. They know that, especially around this time of year, which we're getting into the busy season.
Yeah.
They know that I'm going to spend a lot of time in the shop. You're not going to see me as much. And thankfully, I've got a shop set up here at the house where I'm not far away. But
that was my stipulation, too. Yeah, you got to set up in the house so you're not far away if I need you.
Yeah, exactly. So it's nice being right here in case, you know. And plus, you know, I have a couple of kids, so they can always – I'm right here for them, especially during this busy season. And, no, they're great about it. They understand. I think it would be different and a little more difficult to understand if it wasn't profitable.
Yeah.
If it was just something that was sucking money out of the house, I think that would be a little harder to swallow. But knowing that it supports itself and it makes money, I think it's easier to accept. I mean, that's a no-brainer.
Definitely. So for everyone that's tuning in, some of which that might never have seen any of your creations, can you, again, tell them where they can find you online and what conventions they can look up Muckle Bones LLC in the future?
Yeah, the best place, and I've had a website for a few years now. It's www.mucklebones.com, and there's a lot of portfolio pictures on there, and it's a... just a brief description about, you know, what I get into and what we do. The best place, though, and I got to tell you, I've had that website for 3 years now, and I think maybe one person's contacted me through that website.
Oh.
Now, Facebook, on the other hand, just a couple months ago, I started a Facebook page just for the business where I can post what I'm working on, past projects, you know, where they can see, you know, some of my work. That's been going great. I mean, I've got more people contacting me from that than I ever had from that website.
Facebook so, really is a great tool. Some of us hate it, you know, but we're all on it all the time. So,
yeah.
And I got to tell the listeners, I check out Rob's page on Facebook myself, and he's always updating. And as a haunter, viewing other haunter stuff, you know, it's great to see your process and what you're working on because it's definitely inspiring to me. I'm sure it's going to be inspiring to everyone else that's listening, too. It's always nice to see what other people out there are working on. And it's a great tool. It's, you know, definitely great stuff coming out of your workshop.
Oh, thank you.
So, you know, it's about that time, I think. So I really want to thank you for being the very first interview for Fright Radio. I can't ask for anything more. Everyone out there, Rob Cometti at Muckle Bones LLC. Do you want to say any last words to all the haunters out there?
No, I just want to thank you, Jason, for having me, and I look forward to seeing what you've got lined up for your first show.
So that wraps up this edition of Fright Radio. I'd like to thank the entire team of Frighteners for their great segments each provided to this month's show. A special thanks goes out to Rob Cometti for his interview with us, and to our musical guest, the Messerchoops. If you would like to learn more about Fright Radio, please go to frightradio.blogspot.com, where I'll be posting links, videos, and pictures as they correspond to each show. Until next time, my fiends.